All right, so we're continuing this exploration of the Four Noble Truths and specifically the Eightfold Path for this latter part of the year. And this month has been exploring wise effort. Now, effort is in some ways one of the more critical path factors because we do have to put energy into how we show up, how we meditate, how we integrate with our lives, how do we have our wise actions, you know, come forth. But at the same time, we also have to tread a little carefully because effort can sometimes rebound on our striving mind, our mind that really wants to achieve and get there. I want to start off with a story from my past. I think it's been enough years I can probably share this. I was in high school. And my swim coach, who wasn't a full-time, he was more of a football coach, but he picked up the slack. And when Saturday he said, okay, we're going to do this secret swim practice. I don't want any other teams there, just our team. And he had us bring sweatpants and old tennis shoes. And he had us get all the lanes out, all the dividers out of the pool. And then he had us run around the inside of the pool in the water. Until we got like a whirlpool going and then spun around the other way. So it was his secret technique to really build our strength and conditioning, right? But it was really basically pretty silly to have to do that. But he swore us to secrecy, but I think it's been enough years. We can let that one go. It didn't help us win state or anything, but. The reason I like to share that story because it was a lot of effort. You know, it was hard to do that process. But was it really effort going the right direction? You know, did it really help us be better swimmers, running inside the water, you know, in a clockwise and then a counterclockwise direction? It also sometimes shows us the momentum of our lives, especially in that moment when we switched directions and had to go against this current we had set up. And that's how often our practice is. We start to meditate and it feels like, wow, there's so much momentum going the other direction. To be distracted, to be reactive, to just not be connected to the present moment. If you go on a meditation retreat, I know a few of you are going on the retreat this weekend with Tuari Salah, the BIPOC retreat at Cloud Mountain. It's like the first few days we often, on a retreat, often feel the momentum of our lives. It kind of crashes down upon us because we're so used to going one way. Until we stop, we don't realize what's the impact we've been living with. And then in itself can be an important learning. It's okay, this is what I'm living with. This is how I'm living my life. And maybe some course corrections are necessary. So wise effort, because it doesn't necessarily have to do with how it feels in the moment or how hard it is. Because we can do a very hard effort that's not very wise, or it can be wise. We can do not very much effort that can be wise or not so much wise. We need some more understanding of this. Now, when we talk about effort, when you hear that word, sometimes I like to pull out the dictionary to kind of unpack or name our cultural baggage we carry with words like that. So looking at the dictionary, a rigorous or determined attempt, strenuous physical or mental exertion. And it peaked in use in our country in the world probably in the 1930s and 40s. So I don't know what that tells you. The Depression and World War II. So how can we tell if effort is wise or unwise? You know, how can we measure that? It's, you know, Buddha took a whole path factor, one of eight, to devote to this. And it's a really important link between our wisdom, our understanding, and how we show up in the world. You know, how we act in the world, how we speak, how we use our bodies, how we make a livelihood, the last three path factors. It also really relates to our meditative practices, which is the last 2 months of this year. We opened a wise mindfulness and wise concentration in December. But all of those need to have wise effort to make them work in a helpful way, in a good way. Now, effort is one of those things that we apply lots in our lives a lot, right? Think about all the activities you've done, you know, the physical activities, the work activities, working on relationships, working on your body, working on house projects or whatever it might be. And so we often develop this habitual relationship toward effort. And then we come to meditate and we just carry that habit over without even realizing that we're carrying it. And often in that carryover is embedded in some of the seeds of our suffering, some of the things that maintain our distress, our difficulty in our lives. And so meditation practice is start to make that effort more conscious. How am I conscious of how I'm efforting? What's the attitude behind it? What's the goal or the objective? What's that sense of self that's behind the effort? How much am I trying to reinforce that or get over myself or try to become a better sense of self? So here's two examples of working with effort in my own early practice years. The first one was around sitting cross-legged. So before I had a knee injury and was unable to sit cross-legged, I used to, you know, sit cross-legged. But yet I was a kind of a tight person, you know, physically not very flexible. So I had to really work at it. But I had this theme of trying to be relaxed, to actually, how do I relax not only physically, but in a deep way mentally? How can the attitude be one of ease and relaxation? And so I found ways to work really hard at relaxing, right? Kind of really struggle here to try to relax with this discomfort and this pain. I remember being on retreats and just sitting, you know, very diligently, you know, sit after sit, trying to practice, trying to relax with the discomfort that was just building and building. And then I remember this moment of hearing the temple bell calling us back from a walking period and noticing that a moment of fear arose with that sound. And in that co-arising of that, I realized, okay, I'm conditioning myself to be afraid of meditation. Is this really wise effort? You know, and that moment of seeing allowed me to start to make some shifts of how I actually related to my body and the tightness, my attitude of what it looked like to be a good meditator versus a quality of compassion, a quality of kindness to this body. And this is something as when I see it, especially when I teach residential retreats, because it really shows up, because you can't, it kind of, you're sitting so much, you're practicing so much, these patterns start to really exert themselves. And there's been, more times than I would like to mention that I've had to convince someone to stop pushing their body so much, to maybe go sit in a chair for a little bit, or stop, you know, pushing themselves in a way that's causing physical distress. And they often, when they did that, there was a sense of relief and release because they weren't spending so much energy just trying to manage the posture. So other people, we have to work with, okay, how can I sit still in the midst of? How can I grow around this? I think a good rule of thumb around effort and wise effort as meditators is whatever your natural tendency is, there's going to be more learning going the other direction, trying the opposite of that, right? So if you're a kind of person who, okay, I'm going to set my goals and no matter what happens, I'm going to sit through this, having a sense of when is it time, discernment, when is it time to be kind to my body, to mindfully shift. If I'm a person who tends to shift a lot, hard to sit still, practicing growing in that edge is where the learning will be. So this is a lesson I learned, is that it felt like I was applying wise effort in the midst of sitting through discomfort, being stoic around it. But I realized that moment of fear, that wasn't so wise. That's often how we learn, is through trial and error. My effort really needed compassion and discernment. It's often effort gets mixed up with our sense of self-worth, our sense of who we are, the sense of if I do well, then I somehow earn my place in the world. I earn my lovability, if you will. If I can somehow free that up, then effort becomes much more cleaner, much more direct. Now, the other story I want to bring up around this is around mosquitoes, right? So I have this story in my mind that mosquitoes particularly like me. 23andMe said that's not true, but genetically, I'm as bite conscious as I get bit as much as anybody else. But anyway, having the sense of being bit throughout my years of growing up, having a sense of reactivity to that high-pitched whine, right? Anybody have that? Right? So you hear the whine, and it's really hard to not do something about it because you flinch, you try to swat it away, you run away. And I was on a retreat, again, also at Cloud Mountain, and I decided not to do that, not to run away. Not to kill I was trying to follow the precept of non-harm, non-killing in the context of mosquitoes. And I thought, okay, let's practice with this. You know, I don't know what made me think of this, but I decided to just do walking meditation without doing anything with the mosquitoes. Just letting, if they bite me, they bite me. And at first it was extremely intense. It was a 7-day retreat. So the first few days were very difficult because I would hear that high pitched whine and there was that deep, deep visceral response, almost uncontrollable to do something. But I would relax with it, open to it, and just keep walking. Luckily, they seemed to be kind of slow. They would follow me. And then I would turn around and they realized, oh, he's going the other way. And it never quite caught me until the evening when I would sit down. But I was very surprised at the last day or so of the retreat to hear that high-pitched whine without that fear arising, without that reactivity arising, right? So this is another example of wise effort that actually transformed, that it was very difficult, it was hard to do, but yet it somehow unhooked that fear, unhooked that association, that reactivity. So wise effort. What is this? What are the suttas said? I imagine we've already covered this month, but I'll throw it out there just in case and as a reminder. So the Buddha is speaking, what is right effort? Okay, so there's a case where a practitioner generates desire, endeavors, activates persistence, and upholds and exerts their intent for the sake of, okay, there's four aspects. One is the non-arising of unwholesome, unskillful qualities that have not yet arisen. The second is abandonment of unwholesome, unskillful qualities that have arisen. The arising of wholesome, skillful qualities that have not yet arisen, and the maintenance, non-confusion, increase, plenitude, development, and accumulation of wholesome, skillful qualities that have arisen. This is called right effort. So those four aspects, just to kind of rephrase it, paraphrase it, one is the non-arising, when things arise, right? So when they arise and they're unwholesome, so basically when they cause suffering, that's the one way of defining, probably the most important way of defining what's wholesome or not wholesome. If it causes suffering and it arises, how do I release that? How do I let go of it? How do I cultivate conditions so those don't arise in the same way? So that last section, 3 months of Eightfold Path around wise speech, wise action, and wise livelihood, are one of those ways that we cultivate that. You know, if we're going around lying and stealing and causing harm, we're going to create a level of inner turbulence. You know, we're encouraging those unwholesome things to arise. So that's the first part, the unwholesome. When they arise, how do you release them? How do you abandon them in a way that's skillful? And then how do you help them not arise? Now, the other half of it is when wholesome things do arise, how do you encourage that? And once they've arisen, how do you help them deepen? How do you help them maintain? So you can see there's a lot of nuances around this wise effort. That's not just looking like one thing. And it can look, what's interesting is that, you know, we have about 100 people here on the call, both online and in person. And each one of you, we could look at an example of why of effort, and some for some people that effort could be wise for one person and not so wise for another, depending on what kind of attitude and assumptions you have of how you're bringing that to bear. Because let's say, has anyone ever had a pleasant meditative experience? Hopefully a few people, yeah? Have you ever wanted to get back there? Does that help much, right? So, but until you realize that, you're trying to get back there. You're trying to put effort to get back to that experience. Right? What about a painful judge? Anyone, did your minds wander at all this last set? Anyone have that happen at all? When your mind wandered, what happened as soon as you noticed that? That's such a critical piece of wise effort. When I first started to practice, when my mind wandered, I thought, okay, I've messed up. I've failed. I'm not doing this right. Why is my mind thinking so much? Not realizing that's just the mind thinking more about it. You know, I'm judging the fact that I'm judging myself. So there's a sense of more and more turbulence. I'm not really practicing wise effort in that time. Otherwise, other way to say it, or another way of practicing is when the mind thinks and you have a thought arise, you recognize it, you actually celebrate the fact that you've woken back up. Relax the body, relax the mind, and gracefully come back to the breath without inner friction, without inner judgment. So wise effort really needs that sense of discernment, that sense of seeing clearly. This is what's wholesome, what's not wholesome, what's arisen, what's about to arise. And discernment often arises through trial and error. There's a saying that good judgment comes from experience, and experience comes from bad judgment. All right? So these, you know, all these ways we try to practice, try to make ourselves get through this or apply our old strategies. And for most of us, you know, you can hear, okay, that's not such a good thing to do. It may not be so helpful. But for most of us, including myself, I have to see that for myself. I have to fail. I have to see that this way isn't working. In this way, the sense of failure, the sense of discouragement can actually be a place of wisdom that we grow from. We realize this way of practicing, this way of relating to myself isn't so helpful. Just like I realized pushing myself when my legs were just burning in pain wasn't so helpful. It was counterproductive. But I had to learn that lesson in a direct way. Porter Nelson speaks to this in his autobiography of five short chapters. Okay, chapter one, I walk down the street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I fall in. I'm lost. I'm helpless. It isn't my fault. It takes me forever to find a way out. Chapter two, I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I pretend I don't see it. I fall in again. I can't believe I am in the same place, but it isn't my fault. It still takes a long time to get out. Chapter 3. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I see it is there. I still fall in. It's a habit. My eyes are open. I know where I am. It is my fault. I get out immediately. Chapter 4. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I walk around it. Chapter 5, I walk down another street. So this sense of hole and the sense of falling in the hole and the sense of, you know, it's not my fault or not taking responsibility. As we mature as human beings, as we mature as Dharma practitioners, we start to realize, okay, this is my mind is my responsibility. My reactions are my responsibility. My actions are my responsibility. And we get to listen to the feedback of life. We get to learn to listen to it in more and more subtle ways. If you look at your own life, you may, early on, may have needed a lot of loud feedback to listen. You need things to really, the volume to go up so much, things to fall to almost to a crisis, to the point you listened and started to do something different. Right? And then as we start to practice, and as we grow and start to understand ourselves in a more full way, we can listen to that feedback in more and more subtle ways. We can see the subtlety of that. Okay, I'm starting to go down that road. I'm starting to go down that pathway again. So the simple way of saying this, of this discernment, is does this lead to suffering or the end of suffering? Right? Does this lead to suffering and the end of suffering? Now, wherever you are in your practice right now, you have an understanding of what that means, what that it looks like. And in 5 or 10 or 20 years, you hopefully have a deeper understanding of what that looks like, what that really means. And that's what's marvelous about the Dharma, is that the same teachings have depth that keep growing with you. They start to grow and understand in a different way. Like hearing my teacher over the years, I would hear his teaching one way and think I got it. And then over time, I would have deeper insights, direct seeing for myself. And there would be a deeper understanding of that. And, oh, this is what this means. This is what is meant by this. And then deeper one yet again. So this leads to suffering, the end of suffering. The Buddha had, there's this really practical sutta the Buddha was reflecting before he became the Buddha, that he was realizing, you know, what if I simply divided my thoughts into two groups, the groups that lead to suffering and the groups that don't lead to suffering. And then if I just don't follow and add to the ones that lead to suffering and focus on the ones that lead to freedom, then that's actually going to be very helpful. So that requires us to step back a little bit and notice what the state of mind is. What is this experience? And that's one of the gifts of being a mindfulness practitioner or a Dharma practitioner, is we learn that the preciousness of being able to step back and observe ourselves in a more clear way, a little more objective way, to actually see what is going on in this mind, what's going on in this body, what's the attitude that's arising right now, what is here right now. I often like to instruct that way in meditation practices. Start with how things actually are. Because if you sat and you weren't the way you wanted to be, you know, have you ever sat down and thought, oh, I shouldn't be this way. I should be this way instead. That attitude is subtle, but it also creates a lot of tension, a lot of suffering. One of the most obvious but obscured secrets of practice is the more you allow this moment to be just how it is, the more ease you have, the more joy you have, the less suffering you have. In some ways, it's this profound dropping the argument with how this moment is. It doesn't mean we don't have plans, we don't create things and do our jobs well and do all those kind of things. But this moment can't be anything other than it is. You can't be anything other than it is. And if you allow yourself to be how you are, you create this level of space around it. And something in you starts to relax. So dukkha, you know, what leads to dukkha, what leads to the release of dukkha, is a one way we could define wise view. So I don't know how many of you have been through this whole year with us. I know a number of you have been. But this year we started with the Four Noble Truths, you know, that there is dukkha, there's a cause of that dukkha, there's a cessation of that dukkha, and there's a path leading to the end of dukkha, which is the last bit we're doing, the Eightfold Path. But understanding what dukkha is kind of the fundamental piece. That's the wise view. That's really what helps us navigate wise effort. Because without that, we're tending to go through our own conditioning, through our own patterns of mind. Now, it's interesting, with effort, it starts to become more and more fine-tuned, how much effort is really needed right here. Remember early on in my practice, my effort felt like I was, you know, lifting big weights and kind of doing these big movements from a metaphorical perspective. But as my practice deepens and matures, there's just much more of a subtle shifting, a subtle readjustment. So we become more accurate with our effort. The accuracy is, you can often look at someone who's really gifted or really mastered something in whatever field, they don't have to use a lot of effort. You know, they use the right kind of effort at the right time. And I think about any sport that you've used or really got good at, skiing or something like that. You just do these slight shifts of weight, and that is what's needed. That's all that's needed. Here's a sutta, a piece of a sutta that the Buddha is speaking of with wise effort. And he's talking to a venerable Sona. So Venerable Sona was meditating in seclusion after doing walking meditation until the skin of his soles were split and bleeding. All right, so a little bit high in the effort there. This train of thought arose in his awareness. Okay, of the Blessed One's disciples who arouse their persistence, I am one. But my mind is not released from the effluence through lack of clinging sustenance. I have not deepened in the practice. I have not achieved a sense of awakening or this taste of it. Now, my family has enough wealth that I would be impossible to enjoy wealth and make merit. What if I were to disavow the training, return to the lower life, enjoy wealth, and make merit? Okay, so he's practicing really hard, diligently, to the point his feet are bleeding and soles are cracking. And he's realizing, I'm putting a lot of effort and not much is happening. And what if I just go back to my old life and make merit? So merit is a concept that we're not so familiar with in this culture, but especially back in the Buddha's day and even today in some more traditionally Buddhist countries, there's this idea of making merit. There's kind of two pathways. There's the pathway that we tend to do, which is meditation, trying to inner transformation. The other path is like to do good things and basically get merit. It's like getting credit. And then when you die, you go to a better life. Yeah, that's kind of the basic thing there. So the Buddha, you know, hears all this or senses it. And then he says, has this dialogue with Sona. Now, what do you think, Sona? When you were a house dweller, you were skilled at playing the vina. Vina is like a stringed instrument. So yes, Lord. And what do you think? When the strings of your vina were too taut, was your vina in tune and playable? No, Lord. And what do you think? When the strings of your vina were too loose, was your vina in tune and playable? No, Lord. And what do you think? When the strings of your vina were neither too taut nor too loose, but tuned, literally established to be right on pitch, was your vina in tune and playable? Yes, Lord. Right? So the Buddha's making this really helpful analogy of us tuning a string instrument. That if you ever play an instrument and you know it's flat or sharp, you can't really make good music with it, right? No matter how hard you try. Right, but if it's in the right tune, if it's in the right pitch, then music flows beautifully from it, assuming we can play it well, right? But that tuning, you can't just do it without much. You have to pay attention, especially if you don't have an electric tuner, and you have to really listen with your ear and listen to the other instruments, the other strings, and find, okay, this is the right tune. This is exactly right. And so that's a good way of describing effort. But it's not too much effort. You can't make it too tight. You can't apply too much tuning force to the peg, if you will. Won't work or not enough, too slack. So what's the right amount? So in this way, Sona, over-arousing persistence leads to restlessness. Overly slack persistence leads to laziness. Right? So if you're over-aroused, you get restless, your body hurts. If you're too slack, you get lazy, you get too dull. So thus you should determine the right pitch for your persistence. Attune the pitch to the five faculties and therefore pick up your theme. So find what the right pitch is. So what is the right pitch? What's the right pitch of practice? And it varies, right? If your mind is super busy, there's a lot of content going on, or you're struggling with something, big life event or chronic issues, it's going to be a lot just to make contact with the breath, just to feel this one step, to feel this one breath, to release the thoughts again and again. Okay, so that's wise effort. Other times when your mind is more settled, or maybe there's a sense of willingness to see through this whole pattern, to see the heart of it, the effort looks very different. It's like there's a clarity of seeing. And I would say that one of the most important pitches to tune toward, if you will, to use his analogy, is what reinforces the separation of me? What makes me feel more separate? What makes me feel more established as a sense of self? Right? So just to unpack that for a second here, is that sense of self is this paradox. Because as human beings, we need to develop this healthy sense of self. We need to develop a quality of enough self-appreciation, self-esteem, self-love that we can feel like, okay, I belong here. I belong in this world, in this planet, in this relationship, in this whatever I might be doing. Be comfortable enough in your skin, right? So we can't skip over that. And that's often, it's a lot of work sometimes, how to gain that. You know, if we've come from a history of abuse, of a childhood with trauma, with experiences of trauma, of cultural conditioning, there's all these things that can make it so hard to be comfortable in ourselves. So a lot of our effort is learning to find that ease, that I can be okay in myself. You know, addiction, all those things can derail that. And yet, people who work with that, work with something like recovery, often have this deep sense of they just, you can see that they're comfortable in themselves. There's a level of integrity that is really palpable. And once we have that enough, it doesn't have to be perfect. It's, it sometimes can be a never-ending process. But when there's enough ease, enough comfort in being who you are, then we can start to look at that sense of self. How strong is that? Or how real is it? Is it maybe a better way to say it? Because that sense of self is in some ways the most fundamental wise effort to pay attention to. Because we can be doing, that's why I said that 100 people here, we could all be doing the same thing. But depending on how, if we're reinforcing that sense of self or not reinforcing it, that's a definition of wise effort. Right? I could be, Sharon Salzberg did this example, like she's an author. And she said, okay, if I have this book that I wrote and I give it to someone in front of everybody, all right? So I could be doing it from a lot of different motivations. I could be doing it from, Harry, everybody, look how generous I am. Here I am giving this book to this person. Or look how wise and kind I am. Or I could be giving it from a place of selflessness, of just seeing a need and offering that book without any strings attached, without any concern about who sees it or doesn't see it. Right? And we can use that same quality of selfing in meditation. Like, okay, I want to get somewhere. Okay, sometimes there's the striving mind that I want to get enlightened. I want to become awakened. I want to be the next Buddha. Right? And there's this way that we lean into that and trying to reestablish that. Sometimes we have a sense of trying to get over our pain, to escape from it. So if I can somehow become awakened, I won't have to feel this miserable sense of self. And then sometimes we realize that sense of self is the root of all this suffering. This separate sense of separation. Separate sense of separation, does that make sense? The separateness, a sense of isolation. Yeah, and when I start to see that, that's just an illusion. I don't have to take things. Part of it is not taking things personally, but really realizing there's no person to take that of. Okay, this gets a little paradoxical, doesn't it? Because we are people, we are persons, we do have experiences. The difference is that once we have a deep understanding of that non-self, we realize that that's just a conditioned thing that's arising right here in this moment. But it's not solid, it's not lasting forever, it falls away. If you look closely, we see that sense of self is constantly arising and passing away. We realize our true nature is actually outside of that sense of self, is beyond that sense of self. And then that becomes a very different way of working with wise effort. So just to summarize, wise effort is such a deep category. We could spend a whole year exploring it. And basically, your effort in meditation over time should become lighter, right? Because it should become a little easier, right? This doesn't mean there's going to be blips when you have to really bear down to connect with the breath when life's falling apart around you. But overall, the effort should become a little bit more finesse, more fine-tuned. And then that's with just working with the meditative techniques, mindfulness as we're going to next month. But then why are you practicing, I guess, is the deeper question. Are you practicing to really liberate the heart? You're practicing to really understand the nature of self. And then that adds this whole other level of wise effort. All right, let's just sit quietly for a couple moments, and then we'll see if there's any questions or sharing. And as we sit together, wise effort sometimes looks like this sense of trust, this sense of relaxing and surrendering into the moment. And here's a poem called Trust by Thomas Smith. It's like so many other things in life to which you must say no or yes. So you take your car to the new mechanic. Sometimes the best thing to do is trust. The package left with the disreputable looking clerk. The check gulped by the night deposit. The envelope passed by dozens of strangers all show up at their intended destinations. The theft that could have happened doesn't. Wind finally gets where it was going, through the snowy trees and the river. Even when frozen, arrives at the right place. And sometimes you sense how faithfully your life is delivered, even though you can't read the address. Trust by Thomas Smith, Thomas R. Smith. All right, thank you for your kind attention. So we have a little space now if there's any questions about what were we talking about? Wise effort. Wise effort about the Dharma, the nature of memory. And people in the room, I'm just going to catch everybody up. Raise your hand just like you're doing. Nate will bring the mic over. Online, you can just raise your virtual hand. I'll call on you. All right, go ahead.
Hi. My question's about you mentioning that there's a self that comes and dies very momentarily.
Yes.
And that yourself is actually bigger than that.
Yes.
I'm curious about what you meant by that.
I kind of slipped that in there. But... So what I meant by that is basically that some of the deeper reasons for practice, or the deeper ways that the Buddha discovered awakening, is around this topic of self and non-self, right? So self is a paradox, because as we're talking, you know, as we're in exchanging here, there's a sense of, okay, here's me and here's you. Okay, that's obvious. It seems a silly thing to even say. But yet, if we start to look at, okay, where is that sense of me? Can I actually locate it? Can I actually sense where it is? When I start to look for it, it becomes much more undefined. It's much harder to locate. So it's actually it's an assumed perspective, an assumption that arises. Another way to say it is, whatever you've done in your life, you know, let's say you learned a particular skill, or maybe you had a different role or a different position or job, relationship, all those you kind of had a certain way of showing up for. And that's how you saw the world. That's how you acted from the world. But yet you might have a different situation and you act a little bit differently or completely differently. That sense of you has shifted. It's no longer the same. You know, and so it's seeing that how that sense of self arises based on conditions, but then falls away. And often it happens so quickly we don't really realize that there's this falling away. Now, what the Buddha realized is that when we become identified with those arisings of me and that falling away, it kind of beats me up a little bit, right? Because some senses, manifestations of who I am are kind of nice. Like, oh yeah, I feel liked, I feel loved. Other ones, I feel judged and I feel ridiculed, and those are more painful, right? So I'm really at the mercy of how those arise or don't arise. But you realize that, what are they arising out of? What's it falling back into? And yet there's this, and so you start to look, there's this quality of consciousness or awareness that's outside of that limited sense of me, that limited sense of self. And this is a, it seems like just an analogy, but there's actually points kind of nicely toward it. Like, sense the space in this room. Okay, the space holds all of us, yet it's not of us. So, like, let's say that space is consciousness. That space is awareness. And so that awareness is holding each one of us with all our history and our different experiences, different bodies, all these things. But yet the space holds it. And so you realize that that space is no different than really what you are.
Thanks.
You are. It's a it's a big topic. So if it doesn't make any sense, just kind of put it in the back burner, and also start to, you know, play with it a little bit. Just notice when you're meditating and you're just connecting with this moment, how solid do you feel? Have you ever felt like your body becomes less defined when you're meditating?
Yeah.
Then you open your eyes and then, oh, okay, then my body pops back, right? So it's like which is really you? Is your idea of your body or the actual sense of the body? Right? So just notice how there's a way that the self gets, and when next time you're really angry about something, just step back and notice where am I? How solid do I feel? You're going to feel pretty solid. But when you're not so angry, when you're just like kind of at peace, kind of looking at the autumn leaves, the sense of you can be really quiet. And it can get quieter and quieter to what vanishes. But you don't vanish. You still are there. Okay. All right. Thank you for your question. It's a big topic. Let's see. Let's get back to you next, but let's go. Someone in the back here.
Hi. Thank you for your words earlier, and I'm continuing the self, no self theme with respect to wise effort. Maybe you were just giving some examples there, but how can you discern between the selfing and in terms of wise effort and the non-selfing? Like, where is the selfing unhelpful and where is it helpful? Or is it always unhelpful?
Well, there's a lot of nuances around that, right? So one hand, it's helpful. It's like when I'm hearing your question, but I'm also kind of sensing wise effort just has so many different three-dimensional kind of matrices and kind of ways that it lines up. So on one hand, the sense of self is going to be helpful if I'm taking responsibility for my actions. It's like, yeah, I did say that. I can see that I caused you harm. Let me learn from that. Let me see if I can make amends. That's kind of like, that's a healthy way of incorporating it, right? Oh, that wasn't me. I didn't do that. It's your fault. Okay, that's not so helpful, right? So that's kind of on a gross, kind of basically all the healthy psychological stuff we learn, you know, that can be helpful. But at the same time, on a deeper level, there's the sense of identification, the sense of, am I separate? Am I reinforcing that perspective of separation? Now this gets super slippery and tricky. So I'm going to try to speak around that a little bit. So the one way I like to think of it, the sense of self is hard to see because the sense of self likes to try to fix it, get rid of itself. You know, if that makes sense. Like as a meditator, I really wanted to get rid of the sense of self. But I didn't realize I just adopted a more subtle sense of self that was trying to get rid of itself, right? So it's like this, it's hard to put in words because it goes beyond words. Essentially, it's basically there's a, is it when the sense of self really falls away, there's a deep quality of just peace and ease or sense of being, but it's yet not self-reference. I guess that's the piece. It's not, okay, I'm peaceful. Just like, it's like this roaring quiet that is there. There can be a lot of terror before that sometimes though, because the sense of self doesn't like to vanish. So wise effort then becomes, okay, am I reinforcing that sense of self or not? So for most of us, we have to use this sense of self to meditate. Okay, I'm going to show up. I'm going to practice. But then ideally, that starts to back off more and more. And you know, at some point, you might feel like, okay, any technique that I do, I'm kind of engaging that sense in self to do it. And that becomes too heavy-handed. So it does kind of tend to, it kind of self-corrects, if you will. It starts to give you that feedback. And the final thing I would say about that is suffering is connected with a sense of self. So if there's a level of dukkha, there's probably a level of effort that could be a little wiser. Does that help at all? There's, again, these are really huge topics to... And I'll put a plug for your day long is on the 22nd. So, yes, let's do that right now. I was just thinking, sure.
Because all of us for all these years have been struggling with anatta, self. Four of us are offering a day long on November 22nd. It'll be both in person and online to spend the whole day sitting and walking and listening to Dharma talks and talking about how do you actually practice in our lives with a sense of self, with all of its paradox and nuance and challenges. So it's Steve Wilhelm, Lyndall Johnson, Judith Avinger, and me. And come join us. I mean, we're going to be doing some talking, but we're going to be doing a lot of listening. So I think it's going to be a really good day.
Thank you, Suze. All right, you still have your question? Yeah.
I more kind of wanted to share something on the topic of like the sense of self causing suffering. Mm-hmm. I think it's kind of interesting. There's like a kind of more recent research into mental health conditions and particularly depression. There's an area of the brain, or not really an area, there's a network, like a pattern of neurons in your brain called the default mode network. Mm-hmm. And they found that this is like a network that's responsible. They call it self-referential thinking. It's responsible for like thoughts that are in reference to yourself and how you are defined by others and that kind of thinking, rather than just like enjoying the leaves. That would be a different area. It's a different kind of pattern, and that's responsible for that. And they found that in a lot of mental health conditions, especially depression, there's increased activity in this area. So that's responsible for self-referential thinking, and that a lot of treatments, like SSRIs, for example, they found that long-term treatment on SSRIs decreases the activity in the default mode network. So it decreases that kind of self-referential thinking. That's like, oh, they're judging me. I'm a bad person. I'll never be any better. Me kind of thing. I think that's interesting.
It is really interesting. Yeah, I think in some ways, the Buddha was really ahead of his time, just the way he would understand the nature of the mind. And it's going to be interesting over the coming years to start to see, you know, that kind of research, how that part of the brain that self-references, how does that relate to when we start to understand the nature of non-self? You know, and I imagine that probably, you know, that self-referencing center is still there, just becomes their pathways go different directions.
Yeah, I guess meditation's another one. They found long-term meditation also decreases the activity in the default mode network.
Interesting.
Yeah, cheaper than that. and there was another thing, I guess, at a certain point you were talking about, like judging ourselves when we realize that we've gotten distracted. And one of the things that is helpful for me that Sharon Salzberg, I've heard her say, is talking about beginning again. And she said something like, that when we realize we're distracted, it's like a beautiful moment that we're given the opportunity to begin again. Mm-hmm. And that's helpful for me. When I realize I'm distracted, I will like tell myself, begin again. And then it becomes a positive thing.
Yes. Yeah. I love it. You love that, the way that she describes that, because there is kind of this, it really counteracts that pattern of, okay, I made a messed up. It's like, oh, you celebrate instead the fact you woke back up. It's a chance to begin again.
I also like to use it in other areas. Like if I've done something, like if I'm acting in a way that I don't want to be acting in life, or I've done something wrong, then I will try and use it as well. Like, oh, I'm aware of the way that I was acting. I see the pattern. Now I can begin again.
All right. That sounds like a good hack, good way to improve that. Great. Thank you for sharing all that. All right. Anyone else like to ask or share anything? And online, you can just raise your, over here, raise your virtual hand.
Thanks, Tim, for the talk. So you said two things that made me think of the question. So first, you made a comment about there are 100 people and we have 100 point of views on like the same situation and different experience, and also how we would all find certain things not necessarily like wholesome or unwholesome. So then when we talk about selflessness, is the theory that people that will get to being selfless would agree on what is wholesome or unwholesome, and there is a certain like truth to reality or to our, like, I don't know how to describe it, like humankind or perception of the world, or like, yeah, like humanity, maybe that's kind of at the end of the path. There is a certain, yeah, like truth to like this peaceful way, and like this, when you get to this selflessness.
I would say that there's often a sense of resonance that you start to, you can, people who've had, you know, similar insights into non-self, you know, there's a kind of a resonance. Okay, this feels more true, or feels more aligned with that understanding. Now, there's also the issue that people don't wake up 100% all the time. They may have, it may be a conditional waking up. Maybe they wake up on a retreat or in part of their practice, but then there might be parts of their life when they can still be really confused and deluded. And so that's why I'm kind of hesitating a little bit about the kind of the universal nature of it. And sometimes we don't realize which side we're coming from. And yet there is kind of a resonance. Like if you, sometimes you read, you know, read a poem or hear a poem or you hear a teaching, it just feels like it's speaking to something that really resonates with you. And so there's the resonance of that Dharma. I think, I think it was the Buddha, but it might have been Joseph Goldstein who said that, like all of the Dharmas have one taste. There's that one taste.
So you say that resonance, yeah, maybe it goes beyond word and cannot be described, but it would be felt the same by anyone. That's getting. And when you said wake up, you mean like being enlightened or?
The different, you know, depths of awakening, taste of that. Yeah, and I would say that's even across different traditions too. You know, if we're not caught in our narrowness of this is my tradition, this is the only way of waking up or being enlightened or being holy, you can start to resonate. You can sense that in other traditions as well. Does that get to your question? I'm not sure.
Yeah. And a quick follow-up. So I always saw this like enlightenment and like path to selflessness as being kind of an asymptote, like something you get to, maybe you don't necessarily like reach, but you just describe it as like you may have like phase where you like, you could like wake up and then get back down, and like maybe it like spikes. So is it just a person to person like thing, or
So to paraphrase the question is around awakening, is it like is it kind of like a spike that you get little bits of it and fall back down, or is it more of a all complete thing? For most people, not everyone, but for most people, it's kind of you get these deep insights, and then there's a sense of kind of, it's kind of regressing in a way, or sometimes it's kind of things get reestablished. Kind of the momentum of our life comes back. I think Ram Dass said, if you think you're awakened, go spend a weekend with your in-laws or something like that. And you can see where your mind really is. So, you know, Zen talks about like a moment of awakening, and there's like maybe 10, 15 years of integrating that. And so often there's this process, you get these tastes, and then, but what it does, if it's really a true taste, it changes something fundamental about the way you, your assumptions of yourself and others. How the world is, how you are in the world. Something is no longer, you're not as convinced in that sense of self once you see through it. You might forget, you might kind of come back. And there's also the navigational self, which knows how to, you know, do your job and navigate and have opinions and all those things. But when it has the perspective of non-self with it, it's just, it's not believed in the same way.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Keeping you busy there, Nate.
What you said earlier about the sense of self being really strong in feelings of anger and whatnot, and feels a bit lighter and whatnot in times with feelings of calm and whatnot, that really resonated with me.
Yes.
I think in my experience, it's not too terribly difficult to get to a state where it feels like I'm able to kind of relinquish that sense of self a little bit more in practice and not kind of identify with everything that's appearing. But that's definitely by no means any sort of constant state. It takes some amount of effort to get there, and then that doesn't last for a very long period of time. It's kind of a continual effort to get to that point again and again throughout a day.
Yeah.
And this is kind of a tricky one, because I don't want to use your experience as a goal to strive towards, because it's kind of subjective how everyone gets there. But I am curious, as a practitioner who has enough experience to be able to teach like yourself does, what is kind of your experience with the non-selfing throughout the day and whatnot, just moment to moment?
Okay, so there's the moment to moment relationship to non-self, and there's also maybe the pathway to get there. Is that part of your question too?
Yeah,
kind of that. Because what you talked about, I'll kind of circle around the whole question and hopefully get to it completely. That sense of loosening that sense of self, kind of thinning that sense of self, is a nice way of thinking of it. That, you know, the more opinionated I get, the more reactive I get, that kind of creates that sense of self in a stronger way. But when I'm more, okay, letting go of that, letting go of it. But you're right, it is a lot of work, because you are using effort in a way to kind of, the logic is still intact. There's
right.
a basic assumption that it's going to keep reverting back, and you're just kind of having to unload that. So one pathway is to start to notice how subtle is that sense of self, and also start to notice what would I be if I wasn't, that sense of self wasn't there, if there's deeper expressions of it, you know, even in the more obvious expressions of just control, or, you know, self and other, self and objective, if I let that fall away. And with the territory you're looking for is basically something that's a little scary,
right?
Because it's like, okay, when you start to get that territory, the sense of self is like a little bit threatened, is a lot threatened by that, really, because it doesn't exist anymore. And so there's that fear that comes up. Now, the frustrating part is you can't force yourself to go through that. You can kind of get really comfortable with it. You can open to it. But eventually what happens is just something lets go. And it's like one teacher talked about, you can get to the door, you can knock on the door, but the door is going to open when it opens. And it gets, and you go, like, oh, come on, let's go. Okay, surrender. I'm going to surrender all the way. Is it open yet? You know, and it's just everything you do won't work, because there's so many subtle ways. And until finally there's some pathway opens up, or you see some. For me, what helped a lot was getting a sense of what I was releasing into, right? So that sense of me releasing the sense of self is like, I'm going to fall, do a free fall. It's going to be so scary. But if there's a sense of releasing into this expansiveness of consciousness or this this field of awareness, that doesn't sound so bad. I can release into that. So in terms of go back to how that is shows up kind of day to day, yeah, there's times I forget it, times I get reactive, I get angry about something I read in the news or some interaction, and yet I'm able to find my way out of that, sometimes sooner than others, but right. There can be this releasing. And there's times that you can just relax into that quality of stillness, that quality of spaciousness. Right. And there's it's nothing, and this is the most important thing to, as you're hearing all this, is there's nothing you can claim as yours. It's not of you. And yet you're so intimate with it. And that little bit of claiming that's mine, that's the tension that eventually has to fall away.
Right.
Because eventually when it falls away, it just doesn't make any sense to claim it as yours.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I think that's a really, really helpful way to frame that. I appreciate that.
You're welcome. All right, go ahead. Let's go online. Deanna or Bob? Or Bo?
Hi, this is Bo.
Hi, Bo. Yep, hi. I can hear you. Yep, go ahead.
Thank you for your talk tonight. I wanted to share that as I've been going through this month of thinking about wise effort, it's often felt like kind of a paradox, like sometimes wise effort is more effort, sometimes wise effort is less effort. But the analogy you shared of the tuning the string of an instrument, somehow that the light bulb came on that it was, it's like sometimes it is more effort, sometimes it is less effort. It's about being in tune, and that the wisdom is kind of how you figure out which it is more,
yes,
applying more or less. Does that
make sense? Yeah, exactly. It's wise effort is not so much about, you know, how much energy or force we're putting into it. It's about the discernment of it. You know, and just like the tuning of the instrument, you have to know when you're in tune, when you're out of tune, what that feels like, sounds like. And it's a process, right? And just like you said, that throughout your day or throughout, you know, a month time or tree period or whatever it is, the effort really can look a lot different. You know, and it's like, you know, sometimes it's all you can do just to open your eyes and stand up so you don't fall asleep when you're meditating. Sometimes it's the mind is just so gripping as how can I have a little bit of compassion to that? How can I have a little bit of softening around that? But it's really that, yeah, that discernment, that's the key piece.
So what I have found recently is one of the great sources of suffering, or a big source of suffering in my life, is less about one specific thing, although there are those things, but it's more this sense of just the kind of overwhelmingness of life, the busyness of life, and many different responsibilities. I'm a parent, a worker, to have household to take care of, I'm in relationships. There's all these different things that feel like, oh, these are important responsibilities to put effort into. Yeah. So the question I have for you is, if, you know, what advice do you have for taking that those wisdom practices or applying wisdom to that sense of you know, I can kind of think of how to think about individual actions or individual things, but so often the suffering comes not from one specific action or thing, but the sense of like there's just too many responsibilities, there's too much, it's the feeling of being overwhelmed.
So the sense of being overwhelmed, and is it also not knowing how to apply the practice and all these different things? Is that part of it, or is it more just you're just got too many things to do?
I think I have been working all year in kind of how to apply the practice in different ways, how to apply it in parenting, how to apply it at work, in relationships, et cetera. But what's sometimes harder is how to apply it when I feel that sense of like, it's just, everything is just too much. There's, you know, it's like I could relax. I could be lazy. And maybe that is the wise course, but I struggle with the discernment there when it feels like I just don't know how to stop all these things, all these senses of responsibility. And then if I manage to sort of stop all the individual things, then it's like, then I get to start worrying about, you know, then I have energy available to start worrying about the news and ecologically collapse and the things that beyond my
yes.
individual
yeah,
life.
You got to cut it quite a queue lined up there of things to engage and worry about as so many of us do. Yeah. So this is one of the key pieces of how do you be a householder? How do you practice? I mean, I was lucky enough when I practiced for about 7 years before my daughter was born. So I had enough establishment to be able to engage, or, you know, to bring that in. But what I found was really helpful, you know, in the midst of all the different, you know, activities, you know, because I do a fair amount of different varying things and responsibilities, is to kind of have this central theme that I can identify and connect with in the midst of all these different things. And so what that does is, instead of being over, you know, you might be too much to do, overwhelmed, but there's that centralness that becomes like an anchor that you carry through. Right. So this is something that of the practice of the Dharma that really resonates, that seems really important to you. And that's the theme that you keep kind of referencing. How does it show up when I'm in relationship, when I'm being a parent, when I'm doing this kind of work or doing this task? You can still kind of call that forth. And the other piece to think about is just to keep some part of your awareness into your body. You know, maybe keep 10%. 20% into your body as you're going through all of those things. And what's amazing is like overwhelm is like there's no space to breathe almost, like, because there's absolutely none. And yet if we can create just a little bit of space, almost like a hair breadth of space between this experience, and sometimes just feeling the feet a little bit, you know, while you're talking, while you're parenting, while you're working, feeling your feet just 10%. That can actually transform things in an amazing way. It seems like it wouldn't be enough, but it actually does start to open that door. And then that starts to allow you to be a little bit more clear about, okay, this is this action. Okay, maybe I'll say no here. Or maybe I have more clarity. And then if you combine that with that theme, you know, maybe it's non-self. We've been talking about that a lot tonight. Or maybe it's, where is there kindness in this moment? How can I act from my heart right now? How can I act in a way that's connected in this moment? Feeling the feet coming from that place. So it becomes this kind of unifying theme that takes all these diverse actions and activities and unites them. Mm.
Thank you. That's really helpful.
Thank you, Bo. Yeah, this is such an important point for all, most of us, if not all of us. All right. Maybe time for one more? Yes, go ahead. Let's grab the mic for you.
Oh, no, I was pointing to you.
Oh, okay. So my question, I guess it's sort of like about the wise effort. And so I'm thinking in particular about ADHD and, like, you know, when somebody struggles, like, they might make the effort, but they're not able to do things that may satisfy them or the people around them. Mm-hmm. And so I guess just wondering, like, how you deal with that situation of, like, when maybe you like there's an obstacle either within yourself or within, like, how you're perceived by other people in your relationships and things like that.
And how do you bring the practice to bear? Is this about yourself or someone you know?
Yeah, it could be about me.
Hypothetically.
I think sometimes, you know, like, when you're constantly trying to do an effort that is, like, maybe outside of your capacity, then you can like fail and fail again and again. And so it's like, how do you find the standard of wise effort that like is good for you, good for your relationships, and I have trouble discerning that boundary or something, or like.
Well, I think a good place to start for most things, including this, is see if you can step back and just feel it. You know, feel this experience of trying and trying and failing, that sense of not knowing how to do it, or that sense of overwhelm, and bring a quality of compassion to that, because this is not how I want it to be. And then see if there's, you know, some way to shift the way you're approaching it. You know, get support. If there's some way that you're not, it's beyond your capacity right now, you know, see if you can ask for help, or see if you can shift the condition, or say, just, you know, I wish I could do this, but this is just not my strength. So part of it is kind of that flexibility of thinking, of being able to, often what I like to do when I work with my own experience and with other people, I try to hear what's the assumption here? What's the linchpin that's making this all tight? And often it's a sense of self-belief of how I should be, or how I shouldn't be, or some expectation, or maybe it's there's a not allowing of this myself or in the moment. And often when you can figure what that is and voice it and touch it, the whole system starts to shift a little bit. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Without going into more specifics, that's what I comes to mind right now. But I think my sense is there's some particular things here that we can dive into more specifically.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you for that. Okay. So we've come to our 9 o'clock stopping hour. I want to thank everyone who offered.